Welcome to the Ad Nauseam Podcast, where classical gourmands everywhere can finally get their fill. Join us for a delectable discussion of Greco-Roman civilization stretching from the Minoans and Mycenaeans through the Renaissance and right down to the present. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here are your hosts, Dr. David Noe and Dr. Jeff Winkle.
Welcome, everybody, to the Ad Nauseam Podcast. You are with us here in the Vomitorium for episode number 8. My name is Jeff Winkle. I'm here, as always, with Dave Noe. How are you doing today, David?
Real well, thanks. It's an overcast day, but it's, once again, warm and balmy inside the Vomitorium.
It's always warm and balmy inside the Vomitorium. Hey, before we get going, before we get into today's topic, I believe we have a shout-out
to
a loyal listener.
Yeah, we do. A young woman who lives in Oxford, Alabama, Abigail A.
Yeah.
She was listening to our Iliad series before, said she was reading it for school and enjoyed it.
Fabulous.
Gave her a deeper sense of what was going on in that important epic. So, hello, Abigail. Hope you're doing well.
Is she one of your online students in any capacity?
Yeah, she has studied some Latin with me. She's a really sharp young woman, actually.
Good deal. All right, so today we are going to getting into some Ovid.
That's right.
And before we drop today's topic on you, we're also going to be talking a little Ovid next week as well.
That's right, a two-parter.
A two-parter, yep. So next week we're going to be talking about a piece of Ovid's Metamorphoses, which was influential on this famous painting by Peter Bruegel, his Fall of Icarus.
A Renaissance painter, right?
Yes, yeah, late Renaissance painter. But a really strange, wonderful, weird painting.
An interpretation of Ovid.
He's clearly responding to Ovid in a very direct level.
Right.
But there's a lot of mystery about what exactly why he's doing that and what he's doing with it.
So the Metamorphoses are his epic, right?
That's right.
15 books of change, everything's changing.
Yes.
You don't like the topic, wait a few lines, it's going to change.
Exactly, just like the weather around here.
That's right.
That's right, yeah.
But that is, Ovid's Metamorphoses is really the end or near the end of his career.
Right.
Sometime at the end of the first decade of the Common Era, first decade AD.
Yeah.
But today we're going to talk about the Amores,
right?
His love poetry, his first sally into public notoriety and celebrity.
Yes, exactly. And compared to the Metamorphoses, much less read.
That's
and
right.
talked about. Less interesting.
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
And in fact, I would say that if a person wants to understand the Metamorphoses, which I lecture on in my classical myth courses, I know you have too.
Sure.
You go to any museum in the world and you see some of these gorgeous Renaissance paintings, pictures of Venus and so forth. You really can't understand Western art, Western lit, without knowing the Metamorphoses. I think everybody accepts that. But we're going to argue today a little bit that you can't understand the Metamorphoses without knowing something about Ovid's early work.
Yeah, exactly.
The Amores.
Yes, great. Great. So where are we going with this?
Well, I got an opening quote for you. And this is from the famous translator, Sarah Rudin. So she wrote this in the introduction to a 2014 translation of Ovid's work called The Erotic Poems. Now, we're going to be using the word erotic in this episode quite a bit, but the listener should be aware that it's actually not a salacious or highly colorful word.
Right.
It's just a way to distinguish a certain genre of poetry that has to do with love.
Right, exactly.
Now, there are salacious things in Ovid's poems. You know, there's plenty of ribaldry, you might say.
Yeah.
But not all of it. Much of Ovid's love poetry is very mundane.
Yes. That word erotic has a kind of a weight and a color to it today that doesn't really apply.
It can have a negative connotation. Right?
Yeah.
There are certain settings in which you wouldn't use such a term. But I'm just making the point here today that it's a description of a genre.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Poetry that deals with love. So Sarah Rudin, she wrote the introduction to this new translation by a man named Len Cresock, University of Pennsylvania, 2014. And this is what she says. This is a really nice quote to set us up for today. The most solid and lasting evidence of Augustus's skill and judgment survives from his literary program. Employing his highly cultivated friends Maecenas and Messala as talent scouts, he fostered several geniuses, apparently never snubbing obscure origins or uncongenial political past.
Hmm. Yeah. So it didn't matter the background.
That's right.
Or much less of an elitist.
That's right.
Kind of program, right?
Yeah, so Augustus comes to power, just to give our listeners a tiny bit of history. He comes to power in 31 after the Battle of Actium. He and Marcus Agrippa beat up on Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor.
That's right.
Is that right?
That's right.
Mark Antony and Cleopatra. And from 31 BC until 14 AD, Augustus is the big guy.
Right.
Changes his name. You can no longer use king or rakes, so he becomes princeps, right?
Princeps, yes.
The big boss. But then he goes through all of these political reforms. What does he do to the state, Jeff? Can you sketch that in for our listeners?
He changes everything, right? So I think it was Horace's famous phrase that he found Rome a city of brick and left it a city of marble.
That's right.
He kind of changes everything from kind of the physical space of the city to the political program,
right,
to this famous morals program that,
right,
that he institutes, which is very germane to Ovid's own story.
That's right.
Right.
So after three generations of civil war, where you had Marius and Sulla fighting, then you had Caesar and Pompey, and finally, when it's all done, the aristocratic families, there's a couple dozen of them, are now decimated. They have no more progeny, right?
Yeah.
So Augustus begins to incentivize childbirth. He makes adultery expensive. He makes divorce expensive. He passes laws against these things. And he's trying to kind of renovate the state, obviously still an absolute ruler, but maintaining externally all of the republican traditions.
That's right. So where does Ovid fall into all of this?
Right. Well, he was born, if I'm not mistaken, in 43 BC.
The same year that Cicero was killed.
That's right.
Yeah.
So he comes at the tail end of a lot of this stuff. He would have been, 12 years old at the time of the Battle of Actium.
Right.
Deep in his schooling, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he would have just heard about some of these political events. But the opportunity to distinguish yourself as a general, as a statesman, that opportunity is gone.
Right.
Because now there's only one boss in Rome, and that's Augustus.
Right.
Right. It's who would play Augustus if we put this on film? I know that Brian Blessed in the I, Claudius series.
Oh, yeah.
Great British actor.
Right, right. It would have to be someone, I always kind of skinny and with not a lot of kind of physical fortitude.
Really?
Right? I mean, you don't want a Schwarzenegger to play Augustus.
No,
right?
You don't.
He was always struggling with health problems.
He seems like he's more scheming.
Scheming, exactly. He's got to be something crafty. I think like Benedict Cumberbatch could be a good
Yes,
Augustus,
he's a little
right?
tall for the role.
Oh, really?
I think so. I mean, his height makes him physically impressive, and
yeah.
Augustus doesn't come across that way.
Right, yeah.
The Augustus of the Prima Porta, the famous statue where Cupid is crouched at his ankles and he's hailing a cab, you know, while he's,
right, exactly,
he's
right.
wearing the full breastplate.
Right.
That's an idealized
yes.
Apollonian kind of Augustus.
Exactly right. The artist took a few liberties there.
Of course, because
exactly.
you got to make the boss look good.
That's right.
Speaking
yeah.
of making the boss look good.
Yes.
Augustus, as Sarah Rudin just told us, used these two fellows, Maecenas and Messala, as
yeah.
his literary agents.
Right, right.
So they went out and rounded up the geniuses wherever they could find them.
Mm-hmm. And they crafted these literary circles.
Right.
And so, and if you were in, then that was kind of a catapult to a career.
That's right.
Yeah.
So we see Virgil,
yes.
right? He writes his eclogues, his Georgics. We'll deal with those someday. And then his Aeneid,
yeah.
praising Augustus.
Right.
The guy that cuts the check.
That's right, exactly.
And also people like Tibullus and Propertius praising Augustus.
Yes, the so-called kind of golden age of Latin
That's right.
poetry. Right.
So Ovid comes in on the tail end of that, and what's he going to write about?
Well, he's not going to write about epic.
No.
Although in the mores, he kind of teases it.
That's right.
But the subject matter completely changes.
That's right. right.
He clearly owes things to some of these earlier elegists, but like you were saying earlier, there's something about Ovid that's just kind of wholly unique. And he changes the game. Okay, Dave, before we dig into the Amores, tell us a little bit about Ovid's biography.
Right. Well, after publishing these poems on the Amores, real quickly, he became a celebrity among Roman society and culture. People loved him. He was so popular, in fact, that there's graffiti from Ovid on the walls of Pompeii. But then at one point, he fell out of favor with Augustus.
That's right.
And we're going to save that part of the story for the end of the episodes. You're going to have to listen carefully near the end to see what happened to this guy.
Exactly. Hang in there. It's also true that, I mean, he was kind of on a typical kind of political career track, right?
And yes, he was.
He abandons that for the life of the poet.
Yeah, he yeah. tells us an interesting story in his Tristia, I think, where he recounts some of his biography. He's got this great verse that I really love. He says, as his father is corporally disciplining him, right, whooping him because he's too devoted to poetry, he says something like, parca mihi numquam versificabor pater, which means, stop beating me, Dad, and I'll never write poetry again.
Ah.
But of course, it's delivered in a beautiful line of, you know, perfect poetry.
Exactly. Right? Kind of juxtaposition, which I think Ovid is famous for.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Jeff. And I think that's what makes him so appealing to me and maybe to others as well. is that he's self-referential. He doesn't take himself too seriously. Mm-hmm. He's got a brilliant way of telling jokes in flawless, flexible hexameters, the meter he's using. Really gorgeous material.
Kind of like this podcast.
Exactly so. But less nauseating, maybe.
And perhaps, right.
So what are the amores when we get right into it now?
Well, it literally means the loves, right? And so it's a collection of love poetry, but it's also poems about love, kind of the role of Cupid. And I think, like we intimated earlier, it's also this turn away from the epic.
Right.
The turn away from the grand, you know, battles of gods and heroes and fate and destiny, too.
Yes, well put. Not without precedent, though. There were some Greek guys, Mimnermus and Tyrtaeus, who wrote this kind of poetry, Callimachus. Right. And then there were some Romans who predated Ovid just by a little bit. Guys like Catullus, Propertius, just to throw some names around, Tibullus. These guys were writing love poetry, but Ovid takes it in an entirely different direction.
That's right. That's right. That kind of unique voice.
Right? That's right. We have another quote here. This one from a famous Italian scholar, Gian Biagio Conte, from his book, Latin Literature, A History. So this was written in 1994, Conte's work, and he says, "It is no longer the individual woman that is central," that means in Ovid, "but the experience of love itself."
Yes. Right. So it's more abstract in a way, right? Where you had, you know, Catullus talking about his lesbia.
The woman that he loves, this high society woman who goes under a nickname.
Right. Exactly. That veer from giving him attention and then not giving him the time of day.
That's right. And you have the sense in Catullus that he really is tortured by this romance. He really loves the woman.
Right. But there's this kind of this almost ironic distance that Ovid has.
Absolutely.
That, again, it makes him unique.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's more an opportunity for him to show off his poetic talent.
Exactly right.
And the woman in his poetry, Corinna is her name, which is the name of a famous Greek poetess. Corinna is just kind of a cipher for all of his interests.
Right, and as I have it, most scholars don't think there likely was a Corinna.
No.
Like, as opposed to a lesbia, there are those that might fit the bill.
She may have been Clodia, the sister of one of Cicero's main opponents.
Exactly, right.
But for Corinna, probably completely a figment of Ovid's fervid imagination.
Right. So in some ways, I think he's almost taking kind of what Catullus did and having some fun with it.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah, taking the air out of it.
And here are some of the themes that he deals with in the Amores.
Okay.
Began as 5 books. It was so successful, he then edited it down to 3 books. And the themes are midnight romance. He talks about his dreams. He has an ode to a parrot. So in Catullus,
that's right.
In Catullus, he talks about Lesbia's sparrow. Oh, I wish I could be the sparrow sitting on Lesbia's lap. I mean, who doesn't want to be a sparrow, right?
Exactly, right.
Jack Sparrow, maybe. Don't get me started on Johnny Depp.
No.
Johnny, if you're listening, turn it off, please.
Sorry, Johnny.
Yeah. Ode to a parrot. The way that she goes to the hairdresser too often.
Yeah.
He complains about Corinna's cosmetic habits. Pregnancies. He preaches against abortion. Midnight serenades. He's the jilted lover. All of these strange and sometimes really ridiculous subjects that he deals with.
So when you read Ovid, is kind of your take that we're not meant to take this all this seriously?
No,
or any
not
of
at
this
all.
Seriously.
Not at all.
Not at all. Okay.
I think it's just the vehicle for him showing off.
Okay.
It also seems to me, and I'm not an Ovid expert, but I've read a lot of his poetry and I've had some good teachers. Helena Detmer was one of my teachers who taught me quite a bit of Ovid, and I'm grateful for that. You can't any longer write about significant things in Augustus's Rome, right? He's in charge. What are you going to talk about?
Right.
Something like Virgil conceived. Fate, destiny, the gods, all this kind of stuff. It's off the table because they finally have Pax Romana, right? There's no more war. Pirates are done, everything. Ovid's bored.
Yeah. And I think there's kind of a broad truth to that times of peace allow for silliness.
That's right.
Right? And say, or allow for ridiculousness in a way that tough times don't.
No, you can't, right? It grows out of a kind of boredom, honestly, in Ovid's case, I would say.
Yeah.
So let's look at Amores 1-1.
Let's do it.
The first poem in the corpus.
All right, why don't you read a little bit of the poem in the original?
In the Latin meter?
Yes.
All right, it goes something like this. Arma gravi numero violentique bella parabam, edera materia conveniente modis. That's just 2 lines.
That's just 2 lines?
That's just 2 lines.
That's all we get?
I could do another 2. Obviously, I really like it, but, you know, maybe it's a little self-indulgent.
All right.
When was the last time someone binged on Latin poetry?
It's dangerous to go there at any rate. A.S. Klein translates those lines as, "Just now I was preparing to start with heavy fighting and violent war with a measure to fit the matter."
Hmm. And the next two lines, par erat inferior, maybe give the English.
Good enough for lesser verse left Cupid, so they say, and stole a foot away.
Stole a foot away. What does this mean?
Well, the lines of the elegy, the first line in a couplet is straight up dactylic hexameter.
So it's 6 feet, right?
6 feet. Yep. Super epic powered, right?
That's right.
That's the meter of the Aeneid and the Iliad and the Odyssey.
And right? Homer also, which you just said.
Yeah. Exactly, right, that guy.
That guy.
And then the second line is dactylic pentameter.
Right.
Right, so it's 5 feet.
It's five.
So he talks about Cupid coming in and snatching a foot away.
Yeah.
It's like he broke one off the hexameter and left us with a 5 foot line.
So then, Jeff, this is really Ovid's first joke,
right.
Isn't it?
Yeah. We talk about kind of self-referential. It's,
right.
It's poetry about poetry.
Yes.
Right. You have gods meddling with the physical lines themselves.
That's right. So he was going to write something heavy.
Yep.
Arma gravi. Arma, of course, the first word in Virgil's Aeneid.
Right.
So there's a nod there. I was thinking about being like Virgil. I was going to write about a martial hymn, heavy things.
Yeah.
But then Cupid came along and he stole a foot.
Right. And the use of that word arma, too, you have to believe that, you know, the audience of the day would have
Absolutely.
Heard that word and immediately got it.
That's you right. Know, like that. When you go to a movie or something like that and you see the crawl receding into the background.
Exactly.
Right? It's such a signature.
Everybody thinks Star Wars.
Star Wars.
Exactly, right.
So the same thing, you mentioned Arma. Everyone is starting to get a little excited now. Oh, this Ovid, this young fellow, he's going to try to do something Virgilian.
He's going to drop an epic on
That's
us.
That's right. And then you get to the second line, and no, Cupid stole a foot, and now I got to limp along with these elegiac couplets.
Right. It makes me wonder, probably a lot of this is not recoverable, but how this would have sounded to an original audience. I mean, we can recapture the meter.
Do you mean the musicality of it or how they would have interacted with the ideas?
The joke that he tells kind of suggests that the couplets are kind of herky-jerky, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the first line is epic, and then the second line is shorter, kind of has a different rhythm.
It bum, ba, ba, bum, ba, ba, bum.
Yeah.
Bum, ba, ba, bum, ba, ba, bum.
There you go. I wonder if the dactylic hexameter so associated with epic,
yeah,
and then having that second line being markedly different, you know, how that would have kind of hit the listener. I don't know.
I think just, surprise just, and anticipation.
Yeah.
I think that's what he's trying to build is a little bit of suspense. Arma gravi numero. I was going to sing about war and violent stuff. But then what happened? Cupid stole a foot away.
Right.
Now, there's a name for this, a literary name for this. It's called recusatio.
What does that mean?
Well, it means that you're pretending not to know, which I appreciate, Jeff. It means that you're refusing to do something.
Yeah.
Right? This is a trope in classical literature. It comes into the Renaissance also. I'm not capable of writing epic.
Yes.
It's kind of a sly, coy, false modesty.
Yes.
I can't really do this.
Right.
I can't really engage in a breakdance battle.
Yeah. I think, which you can. I've seen it happen.
Yeah, I have one scheduled for my son's birthday party coming up.
Do we got to wrap this up?
No. Not anytime soon, but it's going to be a little of a breakdance workshop, which I intend to lead.
Excellent.
So.
I will be sure to be there.
Oh, you're invited. You're right on the list.
Now, my sense with the recusatio is that I think even here, Ovid is, he's not simply using a trope that's been done before. He's also having some fun with it. You know, go back to, like, say, a Callimachus. It may have been a kind of false modesty that was supposed to be kind of taken on its face.
Well, definitely, because Callimachus famously says, big book, big problems.
Big problem, exactly.
I can't write like Homer, and I'm not even going to try.
Exactly. But in the hands and the mouth of Ovid, it's like tongue-in-cheek.
Absolutely.
Right, he's kind of saying, in some ways he's saying, of course I can do this.
Obviously, which he will later do. He'll write the Metamorphoses.
Right.
Brilliant, dazzling hexameters.
Right.
But now he says, I'm really not fit for that. It's just... It reeks of false modesty.
Yes, yeah.
So this theme of recusatio that plays out in Amores 1-1,
yep.
We see this in a number of other places, and I think it's worth mentioning just one prior to Ovid, and that would be the recusatio of Virgil.
All right, so Dave, why don't you read for us the first couple of lines of Virgil's recusatio, and could you please just keep it to the first two lines?
Just the first two?
Yes.
All right, so this is Eclogue 6, Virgil's cowboy poems, the Eclogues, and it goes like this. Prima sera cusio digna test ludere versu, nostrina quae rubuit silvas habitara thalia.
Thalia. And Klein, again, translates those.
This is A.S. Klein.
A.S. Klein, as opposed to like Robert Klein?
I suppose.
Yeah,
I don't even know who that is.
A.S. Klein translates thusly. My first muse was fit to play Sicilian measures, and never blushed at living in the woods.
Hmm, that's nice.
That is nice.
So Cecilian measures his first muse. He's going to talk about pastoral poetry. Later, Virgil's going to go on to write the epic.
Right.
God's fate, destiny, Rome's history, all of this kind of stuff. Ovid says, you know, I was going to do that, but Cupid didn't allow me. He stole away a foot. Now I'm stuck with this.
Right. Ovid, way funnier. Virgil, I mean, I don't imagine he, you know, kind of went into a room and everybody says, oh, now the party's on.
No, definitely not.
No. And so these are beautiful lines.
They are.
And they illustrate the point. But again, Ovid has that sense of irony and distance and self-reference that just makes it another thing.
Ovid never lived through civil war the way Virgil did.
Right.
Virgil had his property confiscated, apparently, on his farm up in Mantua in northern Italy.
That's right.
Supposedly, Ovid never experienced any of this, so far as we know.
Ovid, he has the privilege of living in good times.
Good times, Pax Romana, you can travel anywhere safely around the Mediterranean, but dull times by comparison.
Right.
So what's a man of genius to do? Well, write some love poetry, maybe.
Right. Exactly.
So how does the poem go on from there after that first initial Cupid stole a foot away? Then he has an address to the God of Love. He speaks to him, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. Do you want to quote some more here?
Why don't we just go right to the English? We don't want to bore the listener.
Okay. Do you want to do your translation? I like your translation.
I thought you'd never ask, Jeff.
Yes, please. It rhymes.
Well, since you twisted my arm, Jeff, here's a little bit.
Please.
Look, scamp, I said, what right have you to meddle in my song? The muses claim me for their own. I'm not your trail along.
So that's all we're going to get from your
that's
translation?
That's all for now, yeah.
Okay.
Maybe we can put this up on the website.
Your translation?
Yeah, on the Ad Nauseam website, which is under development. It's coming along pretty well.
If people want to read some more, they could do that.
They right? could, yeah.
Right. So Cupid's a scamp.
Cupid is a scamp.
What Latin word is that?
Well, it's puer.
Puer.
It's boy. And then let me check here my extensive show notes. Here we go. Saiwa puer.
Saiwa puer.
Cruel boy. Savage exactly. boy.
Savage boy, right.
What are you doing, savage boy? You don't have any juris. You've got no jurisdiction over poetry in general.
Right. I love how Ovid plays with the kind of the persona of Cupid, right?
Absolutely.
So we're getting towards, I often talk about this in my myth classes, about how for the Greeks, you know, Eros begins as this primeval force that gets the powers of creation going.
Mm-hmm.
And a deadly serious power.
Yes, you don't mess with Eros.
Right. And I would say that's true here as well.
The Green Lantern of mythology.
The Green Lantern? Do not mess with the Green Lantern.
A deadly nebulous force.
That's right, exactly. And I would say that's not absent from Ovid here, but we're getting towards kind of the cutesy Cupid of the Valentine's card.
That's right. So the chubby little boy in a diaper with a bow and arrow.
Right, which in some ways makes it that much more Saiwa.
It does. Kind
of more cruel, right?
Yeah, I think it's funny, really. It just strikes me as humorous.
Yeah, and maybe we'll talk about this next time, but the the Cupid who takes his aim at Apollo and Daphne in
right.
the Metamorphoses, he's similarly kind of, he's mocked he's by Apollo,
right?
But he's also deadly serious, and he kind of says he basically says, "Okay, if that's how it's going to be, let me show you who's boss."
Right.
He's kind of doing the same thing here.
Absolutely, he takes Ovid captive.
Right.
Now the rest of the poem, until it goes off to its end, is mostly about another important literary theme called adunaton. We got to throw in a Greek word here.
We have to.
Not just recusatio.
By contract.
Adunaton.
Yes, which means what?
It means something that's impossible.
Right.
So dunaton, like dynamite, it means power. Adunaton, not
without,
possible.
Without power. Right.
Yeah, so later on in the Metamorphoses, Ovid has these brilliant descriptions. When flood swamps the world because of human wickedness, then you have the deer swimming through the tops of the elm trees. You got the farmer paddling his canoe through his vineyard. Things that aren't supposed to happen.
Yeah, right, exactly.
They're the reverse of the natural order,
yes.
Adunaton.
It's the Big Rock Candy Mountain.
Exactly.
Exactly, yeah. Right. So, and again,
there's a lake of stew. I'm trying to remember. It's one of my favorite songs.
A lake of stew and a whiskey too. You can paddle all around in a big canoe.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
The birds and the bees and the cigarette trees.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful song.
Right.
Also in the, to digress, I think that's in the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack.
Yes, exactly.
Which is my first exposure to that lovely song.
Right. It's the opening song in the movie.
Adunaton.
Yeah.
So we have some of that in this poem also, Amores 1-1, because now Ovid's going to start to complain about how Cupid is taking on too much.
He's taking on too much.
You've got love poetry, but you can't be in charge of everything.
Right. And so his Cupid is greedy. He wants to overstep boundaries. And he wants to take over the arenas of other gods.
Like the epic genre.
Yes.
You can't take that.
No. So as we get into the poem, we see more examples of this adunaton, three specific. So what's going on? What is Ovid talking about here?
Well, he pairs up three sets of gods.
Okay.
And he says, for you, Cupid, to take over all genres, including epic, would be as crazy as if Venus, Aphrodite, snatched golden Minerva's weapons.
Right.
So this is relying on the A.S. Klein translation, which is a wonderful, freely available public domain translation. You can get it off the interwebs pretty easily. So Aphrodite snatches up the weapons of Minerva or Athena. So Athena's famous for war.
Yes.
You can't have Aphrodite stepping into the arena of war. That's just crazy. That's crazy talk, Jeff.
It's pure crazy talk. Right. And nor would you have Minerva, a virgin goddess, fanning the fires of love.
That's right.
It's also playing with this. There's this connection between love and war and sex and war.
Absolutely.
That goes way back. This was not something we talked about when we did the Iliad, but that scene where Hera is seducing Zeus.
Yes.
Right? It's kind of this moment of comedy.
Her husband trying to put him to sleep so he won't notice what's going on.
Exactly, right. And Homer gives us this arming scene of Hera putting on her jewelry and her clothes and her perfume. She's getting ready for the battle of love.
That's right.
And so he's clearly playing with that here too.
Yeah, the Renaissance painter Botticelli captured this so beautifully.
On the shell.
That's
right.
Oh, I wasn't thinking of that one, although that's also a gorgeous painting. I was thinking of Venus off on the left and Mars to sleep.
Oh, yes,
off
of course.
On the right.
Right, right.
And there are little satyrs, these little goat creatures wearing helmets and so forth that are playing with Mars' weapons.
Right.
And it's really a scene from Lucretius. It's from his De Rerum Natura. But the same thing's going on here.
Right.
Ultimately, love trumps war. It's more powerful.
Yes. Amor vincit omnia.
That's right.
Yes.
And that's happening in this poem as well, in a little different genre, of course,
right,
in Ovid's retelling.
So what other pairings are kind of weird pairings do we have here?
Well, we have another set, and that is Ceres, or Demeter. And Klein says, who'd approve of Ceres ruling the wooded hills? So you can't take the goddess of grain and fields,
right,
the one responsible for making the crops grow, you can't insert her into the forest.
Right, she's on the farm.
That's right.
Yeah.
You can't have her running around in buckskin boots with an arrow and a quiver shooting deer and such, because that, of course, belongs to...
To Artemis or Diana.
Yeah, or Diana.
Right. Yeah.
The virgin's quiver to cultivate the fields. It's crazy to take these gods out of their natural setting, and this is all a metaphor for literature, to take them out of their natural setting and make them serve duty somewhere else.
Yes, exactly. He's one more kind of absurd pairing as well.
Why don't you cover this one?
Yeah, so he compares Apollo and Ares, in the Roman terms, Apollo again, and Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And Klein again translates, who'd grant long-haired Phoebus a sharp spear while Mars play the Aeonian lyre?
That's right. So you can't give the weapons of war, the sharp spear, to Apollo. He's a musician.
Right.
That's not his field.
Right. Exactly. He's going to pick his guitar with a spear point.
That's as strange as having Mars play the lyre.
Play the lyre, right.
Yep.
A couple of things here. So it strikes me as that on one level, this is very epic. You're bringing the gods into...
Oh, yeah.
Right? So he's saying, I'm not doing an epic, and then he drops a little epic on us.
Right.
The gods. But this is also comedy.
Because they have almost nothing to do with the rest of the Amores.
Right.
It's all Cupid all the time. But there is definitely a comic element because we're supposed to see these odd displacements. It's kind of like, when you have a close friend and you're used to seeing them in only one setting.
Yes.
This happens to me with students very frequently, right? None of whom I consider close friends or even distant friends.
Yeah.
But if they see me at the grocery store.
Right.
What are you doing here? You eat? You shop? Well, yes. It's always that kind of surprise.
Yeah. I remember as a little kid running into my elementary school teachers in the grocery store, and it was just, you become tongue-tied.
Exactly.
Because it's just so uncanny.
This is not where you belong.
Right.
Where's the chalkboard? Where's the shoe cubbies?
Exactly.
You can't be here.
Right. Go back into your coffin where you rejuvenate. Right.
It is really an unusual feeling, and it's comic. Okay, Jeff, so now we're at about the midway point of today's episode, so why don't we pause for a minute and talk a little bit about how the podcast is doing.
Yeah.
How's it going?
I think it's going really well. I know that you're excited. I'm excited about the amount of listeners we've had and kind of the momentum behind it, so we're really excited about where it's going, and we thank everyone who's listened and continues to listen.
It's been really gratifying to see now, this is our seventh week, 1,400 downloads.
Yeah.
I didn't expect this kind of success.
No, not at all.
Very grateful. How can listeners help spread the word if they want to expose others to the nauseating drivel that we bring out each week.
Right. A couple of things that they could do. I think first and foremost, leave a review. If you feel so inclined, leave a kind word on whatever platform you're listening to. That really helps kind of raise the visibility of the podcast.
Places like the Apple iTunes spot.
Exactly.
Google Podcast, Spotify.
Yeah, give us a nice review there. And then also tell people about it. Share it on your social media. If you think of people who might be interested in the things we talk about, who might like it, please tell them.
After the listeners have digested it, you want them to bring it up to others?
Exactly right. Half digested it, as it might be the case, yes.
So we have at the website now, adnauseam.com, we got a little place where they can check out some other aspects of the podcast. We're also on Instagram.
Yep.
And we've got a place called You Spew Too.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Where they can send us an email, Dave at ad nauseum, Jeff at ad nauseum.
Right, and we've gotten some really nice notes from some of you, and keep it coming.
And some nasty notes from others? Is that
notes,
what you're saying?
Right? Maybe we'll read those on the air sometime.
I think that'd be nice.
Or suggestions for topics for future episodes, we'd love to hear it.
We have received a few of those also, some great suggestions for future episodes.
Right. It's a good way to get a shout out.
Absolutely.
All right. So there we have the three Adunatan, the topsy-turviness with the gods. And we're getting to the second half and the latter part of the poem. And what happens?
Yeah. So this is lines 21 through 26. Ovid finishes his parley with Cupid, says, "You can't do this, boy. You can't do this. Stay in your own zone." Right?
Stay in your lane.
Stay in your lane.
As they say.
You be you, as they say, and stay with love poetry. I'm going to write epic.
Right.
And then here's the response. "When my complaint had reached its end, the boy made to attack. He pulled straight out some deadly darts and aimed them for my back. On bended knee, he bent his bow and arced its sinewed string. 'Take that,' he cried, 'you rhyming hack. And now begin to sing.'"
Oh, that's great.
Thanks.
That's your translation.
That's mine.
That's wonderful.
Copyright. Copyright.
Okay.
Actually, it's not, but
I could hear some music behind that.
Really?
There was a beat.
That's going to be the Ad Nauseam musical.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's coming to a theater near you.
Along with Be That Way.
Oh, it doesn't. That's another one of your big hits, right?
Yes, Be That Way.
Be That Way. All right, yes.
"Ouch, I'm hit," says Ovid. "Ouch, I'm hit. What wondrous aim that tiny Tell can boast." There's a, what do we call that? Anachronism.
Yes.
Because there was no William Tell at this point.
No, yeah, no.
But Ovid would like that, wouldn't he?
I think he would like that. I think he'd appreciate that.
Put some Tell in there?
Yes.
"My empty heart is all aflame with love's relentless roast."
Yes.
So who's in charge of Ovid at this point? It's not Corinna. He's not really in love with Corinna. He's in love with...
Love.
Love.
Right. Right. And that's where I think another place where he's parting ways from his predecessors, right?
Absolutely.
This is something new. It kind of reminded me of, I just watched Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Which one?
With my boys. The first one.
24?
First one. The best one.
Alfred Molina.
No,
he's in Temple of Doom.
Temple of Doom, which we... Oh, that's a terrible movie.
Really?
We watched that one too. I mean, we're getting off topic here, but...
Of course.
I thought it was awful, but...
They killed off Alfred too early, but let's get back to the first one.
Yeah, so Raiders, one of the iconic scenes where... Indy is facing the swordsman with a big scimitar.
Oh, yeah.
And he's spinning it around.
Right. We don't know what's going to happen.
Right, some big conflict is brewing.
Right.
So what does Indy do? He just draws his gun and just shoots the guy.
Right.
And so it reminded me, too, as Ovid is saying, he's flailing his sword around. He's like, I can't do this. I'm not going to write about of young girls. I'm not a love poet. And so
I wanted to write epic.
I want to write epic.
Yeah.
And what does Cupid do? Just draws the gun and shoots him.
That's right.
Right.
So or the bow in this case.
The bow, exactly, yeah. Right. Well, another anachronism.
Of
there.
Course.
Right. So guns him down.
And now he is the slave.
Yeah, the gods that he's mentioned, they disappear.
That's right.
Yep.
Now Ovid is the slave of love, which is another interesting theme we don't have time to go into, but there's this literary phrase, servitium amoris, the slave of love.
Yes.
But in other poets, Catullus, Propertius, and so forth, the poet is a slave to the woman with whom he's in love.
Right.
But now Ovid is not a slave to a particular woman, but he's a slave to love itself.
To love itself.
And so the rest of the Amores is all about this. What's it like to be in love with love?
Right.
And it's like a Beatles song, honestly.
It does sound like, or any lyric that Sammy Hagar ever wrote, right?
Exactly. We're going to work Sammy into this episode, too?
I'd like to work Sammy into each episode, right? Yes, the Red Rocker.
Absolutely.
Right. We were talking earlier about how Corinna is very unlikely to be a real person.
Right.
That fits perfectly. She is a construct for him to use to explore this larger idea of being in love with love.
I used the term earlier, cipher, but it strikes me that
avatar
is something that our audience could relate to maybe a little bit better.
Right.
I don't really know what an avatar is. Other than a bad James Cameron movie.
Didn't like Avatar?
Well, this is an online thing, isn't it? Your avatar is your tiny little thumbnail.
Exactly.
Or something?
It's kind of it's you,
teach
but it's
me,
not
Jeff.
You.
Okay.
It's kind of a mask that you hide behind.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it works here.
So that fits here.
I think
for
I like Avatar better than Cypher. Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So now we're at the end of the poem, and I just want to read a couple lines of the elegiac couplet.
Oh no, you're going to read more Latin.
Is that all right?
Yeah, I guess so. Can you keep it short?
I'll keep it short.
Okay.
Okay. So they go something like this. These are lines. 27 and 28. Sex mihi surgatapus numero ris cinquinque residat, ferre acum vestris bella veleta modis.
Yes, and Klein translates those two lines, and then also the next two,
okay.
Which takes us to the very end of this poem. Klein says, my work rises in six beats, sinks in five. Farewell, hard fighting with your measure. Muse, garland your golden brow with Venus's myrtle, culled from the shore, and sing on with 11 feet.
11 feet. Can
you
explain
that? This poem goes to 11? Is that what he's saying?
No, I think that it's the 11 feet, one line of six, one line of five.
Exactly right. So he calls us back to that at the beginning. So
yep.
It's one line of kind of epic and one line of love.
That's right.
Kind of that back and forth.
It's right. Going to be elegy from here on out.
Exactly right.
Now, did Ovid stick with elegiac couplets for the rest of his career?
He did, until he gets down to his Metamorphoses. But he wrote a number of works in between there. Let's talk about it.
Should we talk about some of those?
Let's do it.
Okay, so he wrote the Heroides, which is a series of letters from women, famous women in mythology, told from the woman's perspective. So we have Penelope to Ulysses while he's gone to war. We've got Medea to Jason. These are really fascinating. Dido to Aeneas.
Yeah.
The woman's perspective on these mythological events.
Right.
Now, some might complain, yeah, but it's still told by a man. It's still, you know, through the mind of Ovid. But I find him really sympathetic and compassionate.
Absolutely. Another thing that just makes him kind of whole unique.
Absolutely. To the other side of the story.
Yep.
Maybe his most famous work is the, other than the Metamorphoses, is the Ars Amatoria, right?
Yes, the art of love.
The art of love,
yes.
Yeah. Such things as the first book, How to Catch a Woman.
Yep.
The second book, How to Keep a Woman. So Ovid says some things like, don't forget her birthday. Make sure she misses you a little bit, but don't let her miss you for too long.
You got to be cruel to be kind, as Nick Lowe put it.
But yes. Don't be cruel to a heart that's true. And never ask about her age. That's some very important advice.
That's all good stuff.
But after these two books, apparently the women in Rome began to complain. Ovid, you're only giving advice to the men. What about us?
Yeah.
At least this is how the story is told. So then he wrote a third book for the Ars Amatoria, which was How to Catch a Man.
So he said, hey, I'm game.
Here we go.
I'll step up. Right.
This is how you do it.
Yeah.
But what about when you're in love and you don't want to be? Does Ovid have something for that?
Does he have something for that?
Well, I'm setting you up here, Jeff. Well, come on.
I don't know if he has anything for that.
Yeah, it's the Remedia Amoris.
Oh, the cure for love.
That's right. How to fall out of love.
Yes, exactly.
Something we all need, right?
Indeed, yeah. Well, I mean, what are some of those cures?
I don't know. I haven't read the book. It doesn't exist completely. It's about 1,000 lines, I think.
Okay.
I'm always talking about it, but I haven't actually read it.
Yeah, maybe you should stop talking about it.
Maybe. And then one of the very famous things, the title, I think this title is great. The Medicamina Faci Ei Feminei.
Yes, the cure for a woman's face.
Cure for a woman's face. A handbook of cosmetics.
Interesting.
That'll get us canceled, won't it?
It might get us canceled. We have to tread lightly here.
Yeah.
But yeah, Ovid, what a guy he must have been.
The life of every party, although he may have been actually quite bookish in person.
This is your theory?
I wonder.
I mean, clearly he's on the page. He's a master of the turn of a phrase and
absolutely.
Stylist. Absolutely.
Psychological insight was deep and penetrating.
Right.
I find him the most clever and entertaining of all Latin authors, easily.
Yeah.
I don't read him for something profound. For me, that's Virgil. But nobody could write as well as Ovid.
Right. Well, maybe he wasn't these guys who could kind of just change his avatar, change his mask from...
Well, I think so.
Yeah.
Surprisingly, you know, the Middle Ages is called the Age of Ovid, the Itas Ovidiana, because he's quoted more than almost anybody else.
Right.
Surprisingly.
Yes. It's hard to exaggerate how influential he was.
Mm-hmm.
I often say to my myth students that, you know, if you know a version of a myth, and if I ask you to tell me the story of Daedalus and Icarus.
They know that Ovid.
One, almost... invariably, it's Ovid's version.
That's right.
Right.
Well, in Bullfinch, his mythology, the famous Bullfinch's mythology, is just regurgitated, spewed Ovid, you
right.
might say.
Yeah.
Cast
and
back up.
Are you aware, it's very difficult to Google Ovid without Google asking, did you mean to say COVID?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it happened time and time again.
There are some funny memes going around, though, of Ovid wearing a mask, right? Ovid, COVID.
COVID, yeah. Seems like a natural one.
It does. Yeah. So the Age of Ovid, all of these boys are learning Latin via the Metamorphoses, violent, sometimes really racy poetry.
Right.
And I guess they served as negative examples. This is how not to behave. Right. Don't do this.
Right.
Here's another thing you shouldn't do.
Right. It's I also find it kind of fascinating how in the Metamorphoses, in some ways, he's turning lots of these stories on their head,
mm-hmm.
and he's twisting them, but they've become, in some ways, kind of the canonical versions of these stories.
Yes, you're right. Not how they were originally told by his predecessors, but now the only version we know.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so what happened then to Ovid later in his life? Are we going to wrap this up here pretty soon? We promised early in the episode, didn't we?
We did. That was the tease, but we're going to end on kind of a bum note.
So what happened to Ovid, Jeff?
He was sent into exile.
Okay.
An exile that he ultimately never returns from.
Hmm. Kind of a relegation, right?
A relegation.
Confiscation of his property as opposed to execution.
Exactly. Right. So I guess, you know, if you had to choose between the two, you go with a relegation or
the
execution.
I think so. But where did he go and why?
He went off to the Black Sea region, a place called Tomis.
Mm-hmm. Pontus, right?
Pontus, right. The edge of the empire.
That's right. Somewhere near... where the Danube empties into the Black Sea. I've never been there, but on the north coast. So can we find a metaphor or an analogy for our viewers to understand what this would be like for a cosmopolitan poet like Ovid?
Being sent off to, I don't know, Des Moines?
Hey, I spent many happy years in Iowa.
I don't mean to slam Iowa.
I was in North Liberty. I was in Coralville. I was in a number of wonderful places.
Right.
Des Moines pretty good, I guess, as
okay.
an analogy.
Okay, so maybe this isn't best. Do you have a nominee?
I don't, okay. No, but if you're on the 35th floor of some Manhattan building and you're a lawyer, maybe you're a poet or something, and then all of the sudden Cuomo, I think he's the governor of New York, says, you're off to Des Moines for the rest of your life with no internet.
No internet.
No, you're isolated.
And with all of your property confiscated.
That's right. What did Ovid do when he got to Des Moines?
He cried a lot.
Did he stop writing poetry?
No, he did not.
He wrote a number of things, didn't he?
He did write a number of things, right? So he's prolific.
Yep.
But in many ways, the tone definitely changes.
Yes, he wrote his Tristia.
Yes.
Sad things.
His saddies.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly.
But why did he go into exile? Why was he relegated by Augustus?
There's still a lot of... It's one of the mysteries about
History's mysteries.
History's mysteries, exactly.
The two leading candidates, though, are...
Ovid himself says he was sent there because of a Carmen et Error, song and a mistake.
Mm.
And the theory goes is that the Carmen, the song, is likely to be the Ars Amatoria, what we were just talking about, his pickup manual.
Because it's so foreign to Augustus's official legislation.
Exactly right.
We're going to remake Rome as a moral place with good old-fashioned virtues. And Ovid says, no, I'm bored, let's talk about adultery.
Exactly right, and that did not go over well, so we think.
What's the other more plausible theory than the Carmen?
The Carmen, the error,
okay.
The mistake, is that he may have had some dalliance with Julia, Augustus's granddaughter.
Yeah, Julia Minor, Minor. Right, and apparently she may have been implicated in a conspiracy. So when some of these senatorial families were excluded from power, they tried to get back in. And the way to do it was to become close to one of Augustus's family members and use that as leverage to take over power.
Right, and
so maybe Ovid was connected?
Possibly. It strikes me that's kind of out of character for him, but I don't know.
It strikes me as out of character, too, because he doesn't seem to have any interest in
politics at all, right?
And he mocks Augustus without consequence at the end of the Metamorphoses.
That's right.
But sometime around 8 AD, off he goes to Pontus, never comes back.
Augustus makes an example out of him, and he writes letters back, trying to work his way back into favor with Augustus. It's kind of ironic, that area of the Black Sea. I was doing some reading about it today. It's a resort region,
right?
And lots of tourists go to this place. There's a square with a bus station named after Ovid there.
That's incredible.
Right. And they have a statue there that's a replica of the one in his hometown of Sulmo.
Right.
In central Italy.
There's there's a tradition that he learned the native language and wrote some poetry in the native language.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Which is completely in keeping with my perception of Ovid.
That rings a right note.
It does. Right? He would do that, right, with his genius.
Of course. But as I understand it, when he was sent to this region, when he was, it was not a resort town.
No.
It was not a party town. It was bleak.
Right. You're going to mention Des Moines again?
Des Moines. Let's go with Podunk.
Podunk.
The mythical Podunk.
Where is that?
It can be anywhere.
Okay, good enough for me.
But Augustus never allows him to return. Julia herself was exiled, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Died in 29.
Yeah. And he's there, I think, for like the last 8 years of his life, I want to say.
Until about 17 or 18.
He's prolific.
Yep.
But he is never allowed to return back to Rome.
Yeah, and he's desperate. Who'd want to live there when you could live in the center of the known universe from his perspective?
Right. All right, I think that's it for today. We're done with Ovid for now. We'll talk more about Ovid next time. What are we talking about next time again?
Next time is the famous painting by Bruegel of Icarus's plummeting into the sea.
Right. It was as a response to Ovid's version of the Daedalus and Icarus story.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. But it's time for our customary gustatory parting shot, which I think you're going to give us today.
Yes, it's my turn. So this comes from the famous satirist Jonathan Swift, author of Gulliver's Travels. This is one of my favorites. He says, "He was a bold man that first ate an oyster."
Yes, he was. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks so much.